Unsere Empfehlung für deinen Podcast? Frisches Obst und knackiges Gemüse von Aldi. Immer günstig und natürlich mit dem Aldi-Tiefpreisversprechen. Zum Beispiel knackiges Gemüse, saftiges Obst, frische Backwaren. Kurz gesagt, mehr Frische für alle. Entdecke jetzt viele weitere Angebote zum Tiefpreis in deiner Aldi-Nord-Filiale. Und weiter geht's. Einfach lauschen und genießen. Aldi. Gutes für alle.
The Axe of the Blood God.
Welcome to another episode of Axe of the Blood God, US Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Kat Bailey, with me as always, my lovely co-host, Nadia Oxford.
Hello, everybody. That was a very nice song, Kat.
Well, thank you. And as always, we talk about RPGs, big and small, Western, Eastern. We love them very much. And this week, we're going to be talking about all the news that came out of the Tokyo Game Show, which was about what you would expect for major games. We will also be introducing our latest report. It's time, Nadia. We're doing, drumroll please, the Final Fantasy IX report.
Ooh, this is going to be a good one.
Because Final Fantasy IX just came out on the PlayStation 4. Mm-hmm. It's a great time to revisit a game that a lot of people love and have very fond feelings for and decide, does it deserve the love? Is it a lost classic? Does it deserve more attention than, say, I don't know, does it deserve to be spoken of in the same breath as the SNES classics, Final Fantasy VII, Final Fantasy X, that kind of thing? So
I guess we'll find out.
I guess we will find out, because Nadia's playing it for the first time!
Yes, more or less.
More or less. I mean, you played a whole bunch of it when it came out, but you didn't finish it.
Well, I didn't even play that much of it when it came out. I can't remember how far I got. I don't think it was very far before my CD just died.
Well, I told you that I originally got Final Fantasy IX. I bought Final Fantasy IX at launch, and I got all the way to the end on my initial run. But then I ran out of gas because I was underleveled.
Oh.
Yeah.
I forgot about that. That's like
so as a consequence, I stopped for quite a while until college when I found a used copy because I had lost the discs for some reason. Mm-hmm. And made an effort to not just play through it, but to do everything.
And there's a lot to do.
Which I almost did. I did almost everything. I did Chocobo Hot and Cold, and I played, I got every single card in the card game, and I beat the secret bosses and everything. I don't think we're going to ask you to do everything, but you're going to definitely have to play some Chocobo Hot and Cold.
Oh, yeah. I always love like anything to do with Chocobo mini games. Like I bred Chocobos for 10 hours in Final Fantasy VII. It was ridiculous.
Yes. Okay. Also, we're going to talk some Divinity Original Sin 2 with Mike, who will be coming on the show a little bit later in a separate segment, very briefly. But okay, let's start with some RPG news, Nadia. Mm-hmm. First up, Monster Hunter World has a release date. It's coming out early in 2018, and it's looking pretty good.
Yeah, I saw the trailer. It looks really nice. Like I said in our last RPG podcast, I was mentioning how, I don't know, just kind of hunting monsters makes me feel a little sad, but I kind of want to still beat them up a little bit, because it just looks like a really good game.
I have a prediction for you, Nadia. Mm. My prediction is that Monster Hunter World will mark the first time that the series really breaks out in America.
Yeah, you know what? I'm getting that impression, too. I get the feeling that Capcom is really trying hard to push it. One thing we talked about on our flagship podcast was Capcom's troubles, and there are many. And they're really riding Monster Hunter very hard, and I think you can really tell it with Monster Hunter World.
Yeah, Marvel vs. Capcom. I mean, Mike seems to like it okay, but it looks pretty cheap.
Yeah,
but
like I said, with Marvel vs. Capcom, you're talking about a fighting game that was once the top of the franchise. It's not a game that should be just okay. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I suppose. I wouldn't exactly say that it was the top of the franchise, but it was certainly up there. And the fact that it had all that crossover, it has all that crossover appeal, you know, with Marvel.
Yeah.
So the fact that, I don't know, but that's neither here nor there. Monster Hunter, on the other hand, it already has a pretty solid established base here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And I've just noticed that when it comes to, like, Monster Hunter stuff does really well for us. Mm-hmm. And like, for example, our Monster Hunter Everything You Know kind of hub that's like detailing the release date and everything, consistently does pretty good traffic. People are searching for Monster Hunter, and it really stands out as a pretty cool looking, accessible multiplayer RPG thing, right? That you can play with your friends. And the fact that it's coming out on PC and PS4 for the first time is really like legitimately exciting. I think that it, especially since it's coming out in a window where there's not going to be a lot of other games, January 26th, just tells me that this is the time for Monster Hunter to shine. Like, it really broke out on the 3DS, but this is it. This is going to be where it kind of hits the big time in the U.S. for the first time.
Yeah, I guess we'll find out soon enough. If it doesn't this time, I don't know when its next chance can be, because I think the stars are as lined up.
The stars are aligned.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the PS4 has been doing pretty well in Japan, so I expect that it's going to do pretty well, too. It's going to get pushed pretty hard. I don't know if it's going to do 3DS numbers but it should at least sell better. But yes, Monster Hunter World out worldwide, PS4, Xbox One on January 26, 2018. Okay, next piece of news, Nadia. Final Fantasy 15. Apparently they were prototyping it on Switch and giving it a try. not very work. Satisfactory, Nadia.
Yeah, this is my surprise face. I'm just kind of thinking of, there's a joke going around about like Skyrim demastered, where you have an Argonian that's made out of like three polygons, and that's kind of what I'm thinking of the Final Fantasy 15 for Switch.
Tabata told Eurogamer, honestly, when we did the technical test to see if we could use the same native engine we used on the other console versions on the Switch, we tried to run it there. The results weren't satisfactory. It wasn't what you would want from a final game. It doesn't mean that's the end of that. We're looking for the options, like the customization of the engine. It wasn't what you'd want from a final game. It doesn't mean that's the end of that. We're looking at other options. We can't currently announce anything. We haven't come to a full decision on the best way to do it yet. We're having very open, frank discussions with Nintendo at the moment about what they think is the best thing to do. It's all under investigation.
I think the best thing to do is to make a remake of Final Fantasy VI and put it on the Switch. There's my free advice, Square.
So I'm going to put on my Sporto hat for a moment. I just reviewed NBA 2K18 on the Nintendo Switch. And NBA 2K18 is a very good looking game. Mm-hmm. It is like very realistic looking graphics, amazing looking characters, the whole nine yards. Mm-hmm. And it almost is completed, ported in its entirety to the Nintendo Switch. It's bugs and all.
All the bugs too. Oh boy.
I, of course, unfortunately ran into a problem where when I was playing the story mode, when your character is in the locker room, the audio drops out.
You think you mentioned that in Slack,
It slows to a crawl, and the audio drops out.
Oh, dear.
And I was like, man, playing it in handheld mode, not so great. But people are saying this is a problem on the PS4 version as well, which I don't even know what to think that in that case.
Bugs and all, as you said.
Bugs and all. So in that case, hey, Nintendo Switch, good job, good on you.
I was going to say Nintendo. I guess Nintendo's blameless in that case. It just that's 2K screw up.
So if you have some real technical wizards, I think that you can squeeze these games on Nintendo Switch. But at the same time, it might be kind of a fool's errand to try and make the Switch into something that it isn't.
I'm not hurting too bad for AAA games on the Switch, because that's why I have my PS4. That's why I have my Xbox One. I mean, most people, I don't know what the story is with kids these days. If they only get one system the way we did when we were kids. You were either Genesis or Super Nintendo. But I don't know. The market's really changed a lot since I was a kid. So if I were to like meet someone and they said, tell me everything you know about video games, what should I do to get into them? I would say, look, if you can, either have a really good gaming PC or a PS4 or an Xbox One and a Switch, and then you'll be happy.
Yes, you will have everything that you need. We were joking on the other podcast that everything would be better on the Switch.
Yes.
And so I don't necessarily think that's the case. I was port begging for a Dragon's Crown port to the Nintendo Switch, because I think Dragon's Crown would be amazing on the Nintendo Switch.
Like, there's a certain kind of, it's hard to describe, isn't it? But there's a certain kind of game that would work really well on the Switch And it's not the AAA games most of the time.
Anything that facilitates couch co-op
yes.
would be amazing on the Nintendo Switch. Like playing Dragon's Crown on the couch with friends.
Yeah.
People were saying, well, you could just do that on the Vita. Well, guess what, folks? The Vita has serious frame rate issues. The Vita is tiny. And not everybody has a Vita.
Not,
a lot more people that I know have a Nintendo Switch.
Yeah.
I would love to be able to be playing Dragon's Crown on the Switch on the couch, mm-hmm. and somebody's playing Dragon's Crown on the TV on their Switch. And I think those graphics, those 2D graphics, would look so good on that screen. Oh,
yeah,
my God.
Absolutely. Yep.
Yeah, that's the kind of game I want. Like Final Fantasy 15 on the Switch, I don't know.
I can take a leap. But like I said, there's a very specific game that I want. It's like kind of the Octopath Traveler. Like, that's going to be fantastic on Switch. I guess it could be on PS4, and it just wouldn't be the same. It's hard to describe, really.
Yeah. So Final Fantasy 15, while it's got its issues, it was kind of a technical showpiece.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you're going down a bad path if you're just trying to cram all of that onto the Nintendo Switch, because it's not a technical showpiece. It doesn't do 4K or 1080p and all that stuff.
Yeah, exactly. The Switch is really about portability, convenience, sometimes in some cases unique titles. Again, I don't look to it for my AAA experiences, and that's why I was saying, oh, okay, well, instead of Final Fantasy 15, why don't you just make a remake of 6 and put it on the Switch? I'd be very happy.
I don't know about a remake of Final Fantasy 6.
I do.
I would be interested in Final Fantasy 10 and 10-2 HD on the Switch.
Yeah, I can.
I think that would actually be a great fit. I think Final Fantasy 12 HD on the Switch would be a good fit for it.
Mm-hmm,
yeah, like stuff like that. Final Fantasy 15 is such a weird game. I just don't think that it's a good fit. But in any case, yeah. So we'll see. I would actually be surprised if Final Fantasy 15 comes out on the Switch.
Yeah, I'm not really like hanging my hat on it by any means.
I would love to see Persona 5 on the Switch.
Oh yeah, that would be fantastic.
Persona 5 Crimson.
Oh yeah, I definitely want that to happen. Crimson.
That concludes our. That concludes our port begging segment of the Axe of the Blood God. And last piece of RPG news, Nier Automata surpasses 2 million sales, could potentially be hiring for more Nier projects.
Oh, that's really great. I'm glad to hear that. That makes me happy.
Nier Automata is the story of the year. We're talking about a niche release from a frankly weird developer.
Yeah.
That has now sold 2 million copies worldwide and is going to be legitimately in Game of the Year discussions.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think Matt and Katie are already talking about how they're going to fight for it to make it Game of the Year.
And Hideki Kamiya said that it saved Platinum.
Yeah, and I'm not surprised. That's really great. Like, it's a really fantastic success story, except for the one thing that's wrong is that it's not Platinum's IP. But, you know, everything else is just great.
Yeah. And people have been saying that we should do a Nier Automata report. Nadia, I think we're going to do a Nier Automata report.
Yeah, that sounds good to me. I have the game and I need a good excuse to really sit down and plow through it.
Yeah, but I really want to get through my Secret of Mana report first. Because
that shouldn't take too long, though. Like,
no, because the SNES Classic is coming out. I'm going to play it.
Yay!
I'm going to play some Secret of Mana. My friend was saying, hey, we should play some multiplayer.
I got
a friend of mine who's going to play some multiplayer with me. It's going to be fun. And so I'm going to do that, and we're also going to do our Final Fantasy IX report, and then when that's done and dusted, we'll move on to Nier Automata so that we can knock it out before the end of the year.
There we go. It's all planned, people. It's in the stars.
There you go. Okay. And speaking of the Final Fantasy IX report, I think it is time for the Final Fantasy IX report.
I think it is time.
Okay, Nadia. So you are not that far in the Final Fantasy IX, but let's just set the stage.
Yeah, let's set Final the stage Fantasy and kind of spitball a little bit about what's coming. So as I said,
well, no, I want to talk a little bit about the history first.
Okay, so let's do it. Let's do a history lesson.
Yes, a little bit of a history lesson. Okay, let's go back to the year 2000. It's the summer of adventure for Square Enix.
Oh yeah,
Or so SquareSoft.
SquareSoft
at the time.
Right, still soft.
Final Fantasy is as big as you can possibly get for Final Fantasy. Like it. Final Fantasy VIII in 1999 was released back-to-back against the Dreamcast. It was the direct competitor. You just did not get any better any bigger than Final Fantasy. It was a technical showpiece on these consoles. And Square was turning these things out fast. We got Final Fantasy VII in 97. We got Final Fantasy VIII in 99. And we got Final Fantasy IX in either 2000 or 2001. I actually can't remember which one it was. Do you remember, Nadia?
No, I don't. But back in those days, they had a really solid plan for Final Fantasy's release schedule. And yeah, IX was part of that. That bang, bang, bang.
If only there was some internet tool that would be able to tell me what it is. And actually, the internet tells me it's November 13th, 2000. Okay, so it came out almost a year, just about a year after Final Fantasy VIII. Wow. And I remember seeing the preview stuff, and it was already looking pretty complete. Mm-hmm. So Final Fantasy IX, as the last game before the series hit double digits, was meant to be kind of a fond look back.
It was
over the past several games in the series. Uematsu intended it to be one big tribute, especially to the NES games, but also the SNES games. And there were certainly some references to the PlayStation games. And one of the funnest things about Final Fantasy IX is going through all of the different references and everything to the previous games. Mm-hmm. Yes. And Final Fantasy IX also was meant to be kind of getting back to its roots.
Because
Final Fantasy VII was, you know, very different from the original Final Fantasy. There were definite inklings of Final Fantasy VII in the original Final Fantasy, just in terms of the kind of the sci-fi elements. But there was no denying that Final Fantasy VII and VIII were a far cry from the original Final Fantasy.
Yeah, even VI, when you think back to it, had like a lot of that kind of steampunk thing going on. They were creeping up towards the sci-fi, the full-blown sci-fi element that you get with VII and VIII.
Yes, so Final Fantasy IX was meant to kind of get back to that. One of the first things it did was it brought back the Black Mage, traditional Black Mage in VV.
The Orko Mage.
Yes, and people, for many people who got into the series through Final Fantasy VI, in my case, Final Fantasy VII, Final Fantasy VIII, this was the first time really seeing a Black Mage.
Oh, that's a good point. I never thought about that. Yeah.
Yes. It was the first time being kind of introduced to a lot of elements that were important to Final Fantasy. For example, the crystals.
Yeah, the crystals were back. They've been gone for a while.
Yes, the crystals, the crystal is in the logo.
Yeah, it's the Yoshitaka Amano design.
Though they did, in the end, the crystal is actually not that big of a deal in Final Fantasy IX. It certainly not to the extent of the early Final Fantasies 1 through 5, where you had the crystals of earth, wind, fire, and water, where they were central to the plot.
Yeah.
And here, they're almost shoehorned in a little bit. But the fact of the matter, the crystals are back.
Yeah, crystals are back. Hey, baby.
And finally, the characters, they were very different. They went for the 3D look, obviously, but they were kind of cheapy.
Yeah, they're very whimsical.
Yes, very cute, I suppose. Honestly, they look a little weird, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, I kind of noticed that. Like, I'm going through, like, just to jump ahead a bit, I'm going through Alexandra. Is that what it's called, Alexandria?
Yes.
And I'm noticing these people are all animals. I'm like, are they wearing masks because this is a theater town, or are they actually like furries? Like,
No, they're actual animals because later you meet a rat lady.
Okay, yeah, okay. So I thought so, but
she's on my perfect RPG team, if you'll recall.
Yeah, that's what's her name?
Freya.
Freya. Yeah, she's really cool. I noticed like there's a little rat kid who I'm kind of interacting with now, but I didn't realize there were so many animal people because I know like 12 has the Sikhs and the Bangas and whatnot, but they're just everywhere in 9.
Another aspect of Final Fantasy IX that was a big deal at the time, 7 and 8 had 3 characters in his party. Final Fantasy IX brought it back to 4.
Yes, that's a big thing.
After all the complaining, hey kids, all right, fine, you get 4 in your party.
Here's your 4 characters, enjoy them, jerks.
Unfortunately, there were some technical problems that came with it. For one thing, load times were so much longer in Final Fantasy IX. Oh my gosh, they were like killer. The first you would have the very long loading sequence of it loading up.
Yeah.
And then the camera would slowly panel around the battlefield while Nobuo Uematsu's rendition of the classical
which is great, a great theme.
Yes. Though I'm actually not a big fan of it.
It's so high energy. I could see though like how it would get repetitive after like 50 billion battles.
I get that he's making a tribute to all the other the early Final Fantasy battle theme, but he leans too hard on the do-do-do-do-do-do as the baseline, right?
Oh yeah, does he ever.
I do like a lot of the other music in this game. The flutes and the kind of medieval music that comes with it, but also the boss theme is really good.
Yeah, I haven't heard that one yet.
Yeah, you'll hear it eventually.
Because my favorite boss theme so far for Final Fantasy are 4 and 7. So let's see if it tops that.
Oh, we'll see. I actually think that it might be... I like it a lot better than 7.
I love 7s.
And I think that it might be up there with 4 and 6.
4 is pretty classic.
Is it the best Final Fantasy tune ever? but still good.
Still good, okay. It gets you pumped.
Another problem with putting 4 characters on the battlefield, the special effects are still good. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong. But in my opinion, the battles look noticeably worse than Final Fantasy VIII. They are a step back in the sense of the camera doesn't move around as much.
Right.
It doesn't feel, the animation isn't as fluid. The camera kind of sits in one place.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
I know that 7 and 8 really kind of had that camera. That was like so amazing to see when you're going from 6 to 7, just those camera zoom ins. And even if the polygons don't look good today, it was just like an incredible showcase back then.
So even back in 2000, when I bought this for the first time and I was playing through it, it stood out to me that this was a, from a technical standpoint, a noticeable step back from Final Fantasy VIII. So some of those elements like have only gotten maybe more noticeable over time.
Yeah.
Another thing about Final Fantasy IX is that it came out at the same time as the PlayStation 2. And
that's right.
As a consequence, kind of ended up being overshadowed just a little bit because all the hype was for the PS2. And the PS2 looked, frankly, looked amazing.
Yeah.
Like the difference between the PS2 and the PlayStation 1. Stark.
Yeah, that was one of the last really big jumps for like a generation's graphics.
Yes, absolutely. So I that said, if you played Final Fantasy IX on the PS2, it was a great advertisement for the PS2's backwards compatibility.
Oh, that's right. I forgot it could do that.
Because the PS2 had smoothers and everything that made Final Fantasy IX look significantly better.
Mm-hmm. Was it faster? So, like the load times?
I think so, but I don't remember. Mm-hmm. Maybe not. Maybe not that much faster, but it did have some aspects that would make it look just a little bit better on the PlayStation 2. Unfortunately, just by virtue of the fact that maybe people were getting just a little bit burned out on Final Fantasy IX, and the fact that it was so different from 7 and 8 meant that it got overshadowed a little bit. But it has since developed a very loyal cult audience.
Absolutely.
And Nobuo Uematsu, not Uematsu, sorry, Hironobu Sakaguchi himself has said that it is his favorite Final Fantasy. Okay, so let's introduce some of the characters, Nadia. So far, you have met Vivi.
I met Zidane. Zidane. Goten.
Yes. So you see... So you see a bunch of things in the opening cutscene. Mm-hmm. You see an airship flying into Alexandria.
Yeah, it's one of those classic airships from like 1 and 2 and 3.
Yes, right from the start, it's really setting the mood of the game as the airship is flying into Alexandria for the first time, and you rather than the very steampunk look or the sci-fi look of 7 and 8, you're seeing a really fanciful kind of almost medieval city in the classical Final Fantasy sense.
Yeah, absolutely. You see like the towers, the spires, the castles, cobblestones everywhere.
In the background, if I remember correctly, you're hearing the music for Melodies of Life.
Mm-hmm.
But like an instrumental version of Melodies of Life. Melodies of Life being the official song of Final Fantasy IX.
Everyone gets one.
So starting with Final Fantasy VIII with Eyes on Me, they started putting those vocal soundtracks. And oh my god, that was such a big deal,
that
Nadia.
A huge deal, but especially like even in 7 with Sephiroth's final song, like just the Latin chorus, even though it was total nonsense, it was like, wow.
Yeah, they really went over the top in 8 with that. With the, frankly, Liberi Fatali is maybe my favorite Final Fantasy tune ever.
I have to admit, it's pretty great. Like, that's a fantastic opening until you find out, like, it was just like a couple of schoolboys having a slap fight, basically. That's what it is.
No, it's an unbelievable opening, yeah. But that's neither here nor there. Final Fantasy IX, so they're heading into Alexandria, but you also see, if I recall correctly, a princess, a girl.
Yeah.
Who, it opens with her having kind of a nightmare, I suppose?
Yeah, she's having a dream about, like, a little ship being tossed around on the waves. And I couldn't really get a good look at who's on the ship. It might have been her, actually. But she wakes up, and it's nice and sunny, and there's birds.
Yes, it's nice and sunny. She's sitting in the sunlight in what looks like a castle.
Yeah, her room. I think she drifted off.
And that aspect was actually really pretty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we meet Zidane, who is the main hero, and he's kind of like Goku.
That's why I named him Goten,
because he has the tail and everything. And tell me what happens next.
He's on the ship that's supposed to, I'm guessing, supposed to have like a troupe of actors who are going into the kingdom.
Yes.
To perform a big play called not Where's My Canary, or Be My Canary, or something like that. Dude, Where's My Canary.
Dude, Where's My Canary?
So
let's go to White Castle.
So they're going into town. I don't think they're actually the actors. They probably maybe kick them out or kill them. I don't know. But their plan is to kidnap the princess who we saw in the opening scenes, and I guess maybe to ransom her or something. That's where you kind of do a small battle tutorial, and that's where I found out, wow, like this is as basic as the Final Fantasy battles get, because you have your fight. You have your maybe magic, you have your skill, which in this case was steel because it's a band of thieves, all menu-based. I'm going into town, and then the scene switches over to Vivi, who is supposed to have this ticket to go see the canary thing, and it turns out to be a fake, which was kind of sad, because I show my
Poor
ticket
Vivi.
To
the... Literally the first thing you see when you see Vivi is him like tripping and looking up like really cutely.
Yeah, he's really adorable. He's like that little black cat. The big hat. But he has a ticket to see the show, but he finds out it's a fake, and like I guess he starts crying because the guy at the ticket booth is like, no, it's okay, it's all right, here, have these like game cards, and I forget the name of the game that you play. Tetramaster, was it?
Yes.
Tetramaster. So it's like, go learn how to play Tetramaster from this alley kid. So I learned how to play Tetramaster, and I played a few games of that, and I did pretty good, actually.
Did you win?
I won. Yeah, I won and I drew. But I'm not sure if it turned out to be as popular as Triple Triad, because obviously that's
no, not yet, not on your life.
Yeah, Triple Triad.
Because it wasn't as good.
And so I met this rat kid who's like, yeah, be my slave and I'll get you into the show. So I'm doing tasks for him, and that's where I am for now.
Okay, so let's talk about a few different aspects of this. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go back really quickly and quickly talk about the battle system.
Mm-hmm.
So even though it's simple, by the standards of Final Fantasy, it was also slightly more complex because every character had their own special ability.
Right.
So
like
Zidane had steel. Have you seen anybody else in battle yet?
Yeah, Zidane was in a team with 4. One was named Blank. I can't remember the other guys' names.
Yeah, so they're the acting troupe.
They're acting troupe, yeah. But they're all their skills, as far as I knew, were steel.
So the thing that immediately stands out is Final Fantasy 7 and 8, were much more like you had these blank templates and you just put everything on top of them.
Yes.
And the only thing that really differentiated them were their limit breaks.
Yeah.
Whereas true. Final Fantasy IX's characters in battle were already much more distinct.
Yeah, and again, that's a lot like 6, where the skills define the character. Like, Terra could transform into the Half-Asper, and, like, Saban can use the Street Fighter moves.
Yes. So, in that respect, Final Fantasy IX is already... The party-building aspect of Final Fantasy IX is already more complex.
Yes.
The flip side of that, if I recall correctly, is that the leveling up is not as complicated.
Isn't it just like, is it just traditional leveling up, or is there something
Yes, it's
up?
Just traditional so leveling
grinding,
up.
Grinding, basically.
Yeah, it's grinding, basically, getting better equipment. Mm-hmm. All of the crazy junctioning stuff from 8 is gone.
Which I'm okay
9
with.
Is. I'm not. I'm,
I was
okay,
not
it was
a
it was a fun one-off experiment.
It just freaked me out, because I guess I was a more traditional Final Fantasy fan, which is why 9 appealed to me so much at first, and then it broke on me, and I was like, and here we are.
Yes, that noise exactly. A lot of people were not big fans of Final Fantasy VIII's junctioning system. It was too different, it was too weird, it was out there. I love it, but I have also 15 years of hindsight, so...
That's true, you really do, yeah.
So... Another thing that I would like to really quickly address is Vivi himself. So this is our first time seeing a black mage again. Mm-hmm. First time seeing a black mage in 3D.
Yeah.
It's a big deal. We have not seen a black mage since Final Fantasy V?
Yeah, 5. I think it was a job there.
It was a job, and people could kind of dress up as a black mage, but it wasn't quite the same.
Right.
Not certainly not in the same way that it was in 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah.
So this was kind of a big deal. And I think that Vivi really just set people's expectations for the Black Mage and maybe even kind of popularized the Black Mage with
yeah,
a lot of people.
Definitely.
I mean, look at even though you can't see Vivi's face, Vivi has the one aspect of an art of a character that matters the most. Big eyes.
Yeah, those big, expressive, glowing eyes. Although it's interesting because being someone who played Final Fantasy from the very start, at least as far as America goes, to me, black mages were always kind of a little bit of a jerk. If you go back into Final Fantasy IV, the white mages are always like, you know, kind of like timid and forgiving. Whereas the black mages are the ones who, like, basically kick Cecil in the balls when he comes back to Mycidia and says, hey, you're the one who killed us. And they, like, cast spells on him to, like, turn him into, like, toads and poison him and just treat him like, like he deserves, really. But to me, I always thought, like, of black mages as being a little bit vengeful, a little bit, like, snarky, whereas Vivi is very, well, he's very sweet.
My impression of the black mage is from those old 8-bit theater comics.
Yes. He was
where...
a maniac.
Yes, the black mage is cast as being completely psychotic mm-hmm. and being a huge fan of stabbing everything.
Yes.
And also uses, loves to destroy everybody with Hadoukens,
yeah.
giant energy beam blasts, like takes great pleasure in that and has great kind of a great chemistry with Fighter, who's just an idiot.
He's an idiot. He likes swords, and that's all I remember from him.
The thing that I remember most fondly from this 15-year-old webcomic is Bodoken.
Oh my god, that's so old. Now I feel
yes.
old.
If you can find it, I actually recommend 8-Bit
Theater.
Somewhere
around,
it's good.
I'm sure.
Yeah, it went for quite a while and ultimately ended.
Yeah, it's actually the only way I can talk to my husband about Final Fantasy, because that's the only Final Fantasy lore he's really familiar with.
Bodoken.
Yeah, is through 8-Bit Theater.
But Final Fantasy IX, of course, with Vivi, now you got somebody who's just really cute and from the very start, extremely sympathetic.
Mm-hmm.
And from that moment, I would say Vivi became the star of Final Fantasy IX from that very first moment that Vivi is introduced.
Yep. Yep. I mean, a couple of days ago when the game was announced, I put up, like I said, that Vivi cat with the scarf and the hat. I put it up on Facebook, our Facebook page, and it just got like a crazy amount of likes and shares.
Vivi that moment, that initial moment with Vivi when you see Vivi trip and look up really sadly with those big yellow eyes, sold a million plushies.
The gaze that moved a million plushies.
All right, Nadia. So we are just now getting into Final Fantasy IX. I am looking forward to additional thoughts as we continue through our Final Fantasy IX report. We've done our introduction. We've talked about kind of the opening moments. And we're going to have a lot more to discuss as you continue to play through it. You're going to... I really look forward to your thoughts. We'll dive a little more into Tetramaster.
Yeah, yeah.
A bit later. Maybe in a subsequent episode. But I have thoughts, shall we say.
Tetra thoughts.
And so we will just kind of keep going through this on a week-to-week basis until we wrap it up. So, Nadia, look forward to playing more Final Fantasy IX.
And and I look forward to your Secret of Mana report.
Yes.
Should be fun.
Oh, I suppose one last note. How are the PS4 editions treating you?
I haven't really messed around with them too much, but as far as I know, you can fast forward through battles. I'm sure will be really handy.
I would recommend doing that.
Yeah. I noticed one feature. I'm not sure what it is. It just says 9999. What the hell is that? Is that like fill up your gold instantly? Is that like...
I maybe give it a shot?
I'm scared to try it, but I think I will.
Do it, Nadia. Do it.
Everything just goes up in a fire.
Maybe it's a cheat.
Ooh, cheats.
Yes. Okay. All right. We are going to have Mike on here now, and we're going to talk a little bit about Divinity Original Sin 2, so don't go away. All right, I'm here with Mike Williams, reviews editor, who has been playing a good chunk of Divinity Original Sin 2, which I streamed earlier this week after some technical problems, but I did get through the opening and everything. I got a nice look at the game and all that. You are much further, Mike. You're in Act 3. So really quickly, I think we should just start by maybe explaining what Divinity Original Sin is all about to the people who aren't super familiar with it.
Divinity Original Sin, all told, is Larian Studios, sort of their own little world that they have. Divinity, Dragon Commander, and a couple of other Divinity games across a bunch of different playstyles. Divinity Original Sin is their sort of CRPG take, their homage to the Baldur's Gates, the older RPGs that have sort of fallen by the wayside, but have sort of come back in the form of like Wasteland 2 or the new Torment Tides of Numenera game. So this is their take on that, sort of a top-down, not isometric, but you could see where it started out as sort of an isometric idea. RPG with lots of dialogue, lots of quests, and a whole bunch of combat. So this is the second of those two games, both of which were kickstarted, much like actually those other games that sort of revived that CRPG style, which were Wasteland 2 and Tides of Torment, Tides of Numenera, and Pillars of Eternity, which you've played yourself.
But it's turn-based, unlike a lot of these games where you pause and then do some things. It has more of a straight turn-based action point kind of system.
Correct. It has action points for each of your characters, up to 6 total. And like the old Grandia games, it actually has an action timer bar, so you can see who's going to move next.
Reminds me a little of Valkyria Chronicles, actually.
Oh, I could see that. I could see that.
Because you're moving around, flanking is actually an important aspect of it because you can do a lot of damage with backstabs and that kind of thing.
And that's one of the things, not a lot of people sort of realize about Divinity. There's a very deep story to it. There's a lot of amazing quests, a lot of fun things that you can do in the game. But the combat is hard. Like, Divinity Original Sin 1 and 2 will hurt you. to the point that, and they'll hurt you on the random, to the point that, as I put in the review I'm writing, my very first encounter in the game, like from the very first room, I tried to steal a book, and I wasn't able to persuade my way out of it once I got caught, which means I had to fight the guys in that room who just straight up killed me. So Divinity is not like, you will hit some walls where you'll be like, either A, you're not high enough level, or B, you're not thinking about this in the right, like you're thinking about the fight in the right terms. But even then, the combat is a lot of fun because it's, procedural, sort of. I'm trying to think of the word, the correct word for it. It's not procedural, but, it's systemic. So if, say, the ground is coated in oil and there are enemies on it, you can light that oil on fire, or you can, say, create a rain cloud, which, you know, drenches the entire area in water and gives everyone the wet attribute, and then shock them with lightning. And a lot of the deaths that you will come across and some of the more interesting events are when your abilities and the enemy's abilities mix. Either resulting in their random deaths or your random deaths or a combination thereof.
Yes, I've seen plenty of people. One of the comments that people have said time and again is that the best feeling of Divinity Original Sin 2 is when a plan comes together, that you look around, almost like Batman, I suppose, and go, in terms of what the environment has to offer, your abilities. Oh, it's raining. Interesting. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
Oh, look, there's a puddle of oil over there.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of that. And you have to plan towards that fairly early on, sort of synergizing your abilities and the rest of the abilities of your party against what you're going to come up against. There are some games that you can try Iron Manning. I think Divinity Original Sin 2 is definitely a save scum game. I would be interested in seeing who Iron Mans this game, because I know I could.
Someone with a lot of time on their hands.
Yeah. Yeah.
So one of the things that I find pretty interesting about Divinity Original Sin 2 is that it's actually a hybrid of a game where you can either roll your completely original character with your own background, your own archetypes, or you can use a pre-made character. And if you take this pre-made character into the game, you will have original character-specific dialogue that you can choose from that will kind of highlight who they are. So there's the archetypes, it can be like a jester, so they're always making snarky remarks. But then there are also the character-specific ones that are based on their backstory and everything, which I find really interesting. So what I was going to ask is, what did you choose? Because I went with the pre-made archetype because it was just easier.
So one thing with the pre-made archetypes is you can actually, you can still edit them to a certain degree. So I went with Ifan Bin Mezd. And I made him a battle mage, but I changed his face and I changed his starting abilities. So there is some flexibility to that, but yeah. So basically, there are six pre-made characters. Ifan Bin Mezd, who is a mercenary as a part of a group called the Lone Wolves. Lose, who is a singer who is also possessed by demons. Red Prince, a lizard who once was a noble and lost his empire. Sibyl, who's an elf assassin who was formerly a slave and now wants revenge. Beast, who is a dwarf sort of warrior that eventually became a pirate. I'm trying to stay away from spoilers as much as possible for you guys.
And when the game starts, you are on a slave ship, basically.
Correct.
And they're all there with you.
Right. And the last one is Fane, who is an Eternal. So he's an undead who is trying to find out what happened to his people. But yes, the point is, a person, who is fairly large in the game starts some stuff in the middle of a town. So you're called sorcerers. They're people who can use the source. So this is like an extra level on top of the magic of the world already. The problem is anytime you use a source ability, you call down, void, walkers or void awoken, I believe it's called. So using these abilities calls monsters. So the person that sort of kicks off everything, calls void awoken in the middle of a town. And so everyone's on a slave ship. You're all wrapped up X-Men style. And your first act is sort of to get away from prison.
Those void monsters be woke.
Right. So then I chose Ifan, but the other characters are your companions. So anyone that you don't choose, and if you create a complete custom character, which I wouldn't recommend probably for your first time around, because the special characters have special origin tags that sort of add extra flavor to the game. But whichever ones you don't choose can be found in the game as companions. So I chose Ifan, and my primary party, I have everybody, but my primary party is the Red Prince, Sibyl, Fane, cause it's a party of four. So, but they're all pretty flexible. Like the Red Prince starts off as a fighter, but you can turn them into anything you want. The game is amazingly flexible. Like you're not.
I made him into an elemental mage actually with fire. Yes,
fire.
I was already a fighter, so I needed somebody who could do fire stuff.
Yeah, see, I was a battle mage, so I needed a more frontline tank. So I left him as the fighter that he already was. My mage was Fane. Essentially, it's a very flexible game about building sort of this team that you have. You can turn them into anything. You can respec. Once you get to a certain point, you can respec pretty much anytime you go back to town. And that's another like tip I'd probably say to people. Like if you're starting the game out, it can be a bit daunting and overwhelming. But it's not like
just a bit.
Yeah. It's not, because eventually Larian is very open about letting you be like, oh yeah, just go ahead. Just change it, because you're playing by yourself. So it's one of those things like, why are we forcing you to be this forever? When you're playing a single player game, it's much better to let people have fun, and I sort of appreciate them for that.
A few things that stand out to me about Divinity Original Sin 2, it's a really pretty game. Oh yeah. Very attractive, playing on my PC. It's not that complicated. You can see the seams in what they've chosen to focus on, like say the text boxes with the little dialogue portraits are actually pretty simple, all things considered. And when you're watching the cutscenes, they're barely animated static art, but it still looks really good. It just goes to show that the style can really make all the difference in a game like this. You've had a time to play a whole lot more of it. I'm curious to hear, how's it holding up? How's it going? Like, is it really worth diving into?
Oh Lord, yes. Divinity Original Sin 2 is probably one of the best CRPGs I've ever played. Like, there are definitely some moments, say in the story, that aren't as executed as well in the primary story, but then that's backed up by the subplots and sort of side quests that you can take. There's definitely, I think, sort of an issue with certain encounters which just feel like utter walls until you get through them. And I think the game could be better about that. But overall, it's an amazing CRPG. And even beyond that, you have a cooperative multiplayer mode, You have the arena, which is PvP multiplayer. You have the game master mode, which is where one player can be like an actual game master, dropping monsters and NPCs and giving their friends and stuff quests, while the others sort of play through it. There's just a lot. Like, Larian really shows like a love of RPG in the, like, the name RPG, role playing game. And I think, that shows really in Divinity Original Sin 2, even more so than it did in the first game, which was one of my favorites, when it came out.
Something I've noticed is, I don't know if it's because Destiny 2 came out and has kind of sucked the oxygen out of the environment for a lot of different things, but it seems to me that, or maybe it's because Divinity Original Sin 2 has been in early access for a while now. So, I mean, it's been kind of a known quantity, but it seems like there hasn't been a ton of hype for Divinity Original Sin 2 to this point. What do you attribute that to?
I mean, I would say this is, Divinity Original Sin 2 is probably not a game that's gonna, like, really tear up in terms of a, like, wide word of mouth. I still think it's a very good game, but I still think it's a game that appeals to a very, like, a specific type of player. And I think those players will love it. But I mean, it's doing really well. It has far exceeded their sales. I forget how many copies. I want to say like 500,000 already. But over on the Steam stats, they were at 62,000 peak players, 66, something like that, which puts them puts them above everything else except PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, Counter-Strike GO, and Dota 2. So it's a fairly popular and widely played game. It's just the people who are playing it are talking about it in specific spaces, not like, out on Reddit games or something like that. There's no reason for them to go out and talk because probably they think like I do that this is a game for CRPG fanatics and fans.
Kind of a perfect storm of the game was in early access. We didn't get final review code until it was almost out.
Right.
It's a long RPG, so you have to like kind of play through it to be able to really talk about it at length.
Yeah,
and it's not on console.
Yeah, it's not on console, and it will be because it has controller support. At some point, I'm sure, but, it probably also didn't help that we got review code, like, a couple days before launch, which is why you've been seeing, reviews sort of trickling out over this week, slowly. Some people played more, fairly quickly, like PC Gamer, because they didn't have Destiny 2 to worry about.
And because, I mean, Divinity Original Sin 2 is so their jam,
yeah,
right?
I mean,
it's right squarely in their wheelhouse.
Yeah, but
better cover it.
But some of the other reviews, like Rock, Paper, Shotgun went up yesterday. Somebody else went up today. Eurogamer went up today. Ours will be going up today. So it's been definitely a staggered review thing. So it wasn't like everyone were able to come out and be like, wow, this game is getting amazing reviews. Look at all these reviews. Cause it was like maybe two or three when it first came out. So it's one of those things, but I don't think it's necessarily hurting the game because again, I don't think this is a game that's going to appeal to, like, Destiny is very good at being a game that's sort of an entry level MMO. Because it's a first-person shooter, and you can get into it really easily. I don't think this is that game, because like I said, I literally, in my first, like, that first starting intro area, I died once just seeing what was happening, and then I died a second time because I wasn't paying attention in a fight.
I think the Venn diagram between Destiny 2 and Divinity Original Sin 2 is actually not that close, all things considered.
No. No, not at all. So it's a very good game. And spoiler alert, my review is going to be another one of our 5 out of 5s. You can look at my review, you can look at other reviews. It's reviewing very highly, and the fans who have played it really love it. I think if this is your thing, if you like games like Wasteland or Torment, like Planescape Torment, or Baldur's Gate, or even newer games like Pillars of Eternity, this is a really good game for you, I think.
Well, I've got a ton of games on my backlog, unfortunately, so it's going to be tough for me to really dive in anytime soon, but I definitely have it on my radar, and you should too. You should definitely be picking up Divinity Original Sin 2, because it is a really intriguing game, and I mean, but if you don't pick it up now, it's probably going to be coming out on console at some point. But all right, Mike, thanks for coming on the show and talking a little bit about Divinity Original Sin 2. Really appreciate it. Make sure to check out Mike over on the US Gamer Podcast, which he is leading now. All right, we're going to head on over to reader letters, so don't go away. All right, Nadia, as always, we have comments from the listeners, and this week we are going to start out with a letter. It's titled Fallout Talk Plus Badass Party, and this is from Renee DaCosta, and Renee says, Kapla, Kat and Nadia. I read, listened to all the recent New Vegas talk, but Renee wants to explain why Final Fallout 3 is the superior game overall, okay? Oh. So, getting this out of the way, main quest in Fallout 3 sucks. It is extremely binary, with Enclave supervillains and Brotherhood being super rad. The Broken Steel DLC adds a bit of death, but not much. The factions in New Vegas blow it away. I said, while the action and consequence of New Vegas were exciting and dynamic, the world of New Vegas is a bore to transverse. At Fallout 3, when you arise from the vault and see a ruined, depopulated metropolis, the entirety of downtown DC is a super mutant wasteland with captives and shopping cart cages and with you fighting for your life. The subway system is full of ghouls. Yes, the areas in between are random raider encampments. The world feels hostile and threatening and is very much behooves you to explore and avoid the main quest line. And while the main quest is pretty lame, you run into many exciting episodic adventures in between. Who forgets siding with the ghouls in that asshole apartment tower a la Land of the Dead? Or deciding what to do with the mutated tree man? Or hunting down the vampire clan? Or fucking over Megaton? Or the Vault of Gary? Or the Hallucination Vault? Hell, all the vaults were pretty exciting. I'm not saying that New Vegas didn't have anything similar, but everything was laser focused on the eventual outcome of the dam. The wider world of 3 just felt, well, wilder. It sucks to explore New Vegas prior to going to the Strip. The entire world feels overly populated and super mutants are totally cool now, so don't worry. This is fine because the wider political story is excellent with the showdown of NCR House Caesar, but the desert landscape isn't as fun, and aside from occasional wrecks, it looks like sort of like actual Vegas now. The pre-Strip area is more or less Fremont. I dare say there is nothing of consequence to do prior to the Strip, and that is where the game begins in earnest, where it gets exciting. Fallout 3 is fun to explore physically. New Vegas is fun to explore in consequences. Go Legion. Oh, man, Caesar Legion.
I actually played quite a bit of 3. I never finished it, but I did play it, and I was recently in D.C., and I was in the subways, and I was like, huh, okay, well, this looks familiar. 3 freaked the hell out of me in a couple of instances. Number one being the subways. I'm like, oh, that's it. I'm out. And also, at one point, I was just kind of minding my own business, and I turn around, and there's a Mirelurk running towards me, like, totally silently, and I just freaked, and I just ran. And thankfully, there was, like, a merchant nearby who shot it for me, but 3 is a very, very depressing game, because as you say, yes, it is a wasteland. Everything is just ruined, and there's only so much gray and dirt I can take, but even given the consequences, one reason I liked 4, at least visually, a little bit more is because it really had the world starting to kind of mend a little bit. And I'm the kind of person who's really fascinated with the Chernobyl dead zone and just how, like, everything's kind of bounced back in its own radiated way. So 3 being just nothing but rubble and dirt was just kind of like, yeah.
One of my favorite pictures was actually on Kotaku right after Barack Obama was sworn in for his inauguration. Mm-hmm. And there's a great picture of Obama looking out over a giant crowd in the, you know, in D.C., mm-hmm. right on the Capitol Hill lawn mall. And Kotaku went to that same spot in Fallout 3 and just looked out at the same ruined area and juxtaposed it.
Nice.
That was always a really striking image for me.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
If you missed it the first time, over on US Gamers, our Fallout New Vegas retrospective making of, where we talked to various Obsidian folks about how it all came together, hopefully offered a lot of sights and insight into how the different quests came together, the factions, that kind of thing, the DLC. So go and read that and listen to the previous episode, because we also talk about it at some length there. By the way, Renee has a party of badasses.
Oh boy.
Leader, Cthulhu. Cthulhu saves the world. there is some what appears to be Cthulhu speech. Thief is Hrothgar from Dragon Age Origins. I made a low-caste dwarf rogue. He was cool and set traps. Mage, Magus from Chrono Trigger. Emo bad boy. The healer is Saiten from Xenogears. Healer, sword fighter, robot pilot, raconteur. And the tank is Iron Bull from Dragon Age Inquisition. I rode the bull. Also had to nuke his ass in the DLC. Yes, Iron Bull. Okay, thanks, Renee, for writing in. And as always, we're still looking for your perfect RPG parties, and we always enjoy reading them. We've gotten quite a few. I think my favorite is still the robot one.
That was pretty awesome.
It was pretty awesome. And of course, if you write in, leave a note on the show notes for the podcast, or send me an email at usgamer@usgamer.net, we may read your letter on the show. Okay. Axe of Blood God is a US Gamer podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, wherever else podcasts are sold. Many ways to connect to us. Follow us on Twitter at @_Capbot, Nadia at Nadia Oxford, and of course the site is USGamerNet. Follow us on Facebook at USGamerNet, and everything else. We stream twice a week on Twitch. Nadia, we're gonna have some fun next week. We're gonna do a SNES Classic Marathon.
Yes, that's gonna be a lot of fun.
Yes, I'm gonna be spending several hours on the day of the SNES Classic's release, just chilling and playing some SNES Classic. I'm going through a whole bunch of different games. Just come hang out with me. It'll be on a Friday. You know, you don't have to work.
Me too.
Just grab a beer from your company's fridge, or just sneak over to a PC, have a tablet with you, and watch some streams.
Forget productivity.
Have some fun. Man, the SNES Classic's out next week. I wonder if I'm actually going to be able to get one.
Yeah, I'm wondering that. Me too. I mean, I'm supposed to get a review unit, but it hasn't arrived.
No, you'll be getting the review unit hopefully very soon. Maybe tomorrow. But I'm just going to steal Katie's for the stream, because she's getting one. Because
that's
of course.
Right. You guys live close together.
We do live close together. I'm also planning on going to the local GameStop mm-hmm. and standing in line and hoping for the best.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, thanks. All right, so we'll be doing that. And, of course, we'll be continuing on with our Final Fantasy IX report and many other reports besides Secret of Mana report and all of that. So please look forward to that. Oh, and you should go listen to our other podcast, the flagship podcast, the US Gamer Podcast, which I'm no longer on.
Aw, we miss you, Kat.
Yes, Mike stabbed me on the back and pushed me out of the show. Actually, that's not true.
You're like, Mike's capable of that.
I was like, actually, I don't have time to produce two podcasts in a row. So I had the reins off to Mike, Nadia, and Katie. And you know what? I really like the chemistry that you guys have. You have a really nice, easygoing flow. You talk about a variety of different topics. And it's nice for me not being there, because I think it now has a different voice.
Yeah, one thing about podcasts is they take up a lot of energy, even just being on them.
Yes, even just being on them. People are like, oh, podcasting, that's really easy. Man, if you just podcasting would be the life. It's true. It's fun. It's good. But you're not just hanging out and talking. You always have to be on,
yeah.
Right?
Yep, 100%.
Yeah, and this past week, you were talking about Marvel vs. Capcom Infinite. You were talking about Danganronpa V3. You were joking about how everything is better on the Switch. We were getting some dark revelations from Katie. And we were talking about cross-platform play. So you guys covered a lot.
Yeah, we had a nice discussion there.
Yes. So you can go subscribe to the U.S. Gamer Podcast on iTunes, Google Play. You know where to find it. So please go and do that. And also do me a favor, if you're enjoying the show, leave a review.
Please, please, please.
If you leave a review, that will make the show more visible on our various platforms, especially Stitcher, but also iTunes and Google Play. We really appreciate hearing feedback from our fans. Okay, Nadia, we'll be back again, as always, next week. We'll continue with our Final Fantasy IX report, maybe kick off our Secret of Mana report, maybe not. And until then, I've been Kat Bailey, and for Nadia, Mike, and myself, thanks for listening. Until the next time, happy adventuring. We'll be right back.